This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Lester Graham. Today we hear about lawsuits trying to block an independent commission from drawing legislative maps. Then our political commentators on trying to hammer out something like a plan to fix the roads.
Some days you think you made a lot of progress. The next day you're madder than a wet hand. And you say, I'm never going to talk to that person again. And then 12 hours later, you're back at the table.
What happened when Michigan State University tried to give Bolivia a piece of its history?
One doesn't just say, gee, we're going to give you back your mummy.
We'll talk about environmental ethics today.
Most people are concerned about this and think about it occasionally, but don't really have the time or the mental space to be thinking about it on a purchase-by-purchase decision.
And a charter boat fishing captain on business after cyanobacteria blooms on Lake Erie.
What happens is we don't get the phone calls anymore.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Climate change is happening, so what are people doing about it? What can people do about it? Later on the program, we'll talk about the tough ethical choices people are facing every day around the environment. But first, this week, the state Republican Party filed a lawsuit to stop a voter-approved redistricting process, which includes an independent commission drawing Michigan's legislative and congressional districts. Here to explain the reasoning for the challenge is Stu Sandler, general counsel for the Michigan Republican Party. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So what is the reasoning behind this lawsuit?
Well, if you take a look at the structure that was passed, we believe that it violates association rights, First Amendment rights, equal protection rights, and it's unconstitutional, it's unfair for both the Republican Party and for political parties in general and its members.
In what way? Explain it to me. Break it down.
Sure. I think one of the ways is that the Republican Party, by history and by constitutional role, has always been allowed to define who associates with it and who represents it, and the Democratic Party in the same way. That's why in most cases we're involving election law, you will have a Republican Party actually appoint the persons involved. Michigan has taken up an independent redistricting committee. The problem with it, it says who is allowed to represent the Republican Party on it. That the Republican Party really doesn't have a role in saying who its membership is. And in every other state that set this up, either Republican Party or elected officials have selected that, or they've used voter registration history that's shown that people have very specific alliance with the Republican Party and to represent the interests of them in this process.
The Associated Press quoted the executive director of Voters Not Politicians, the group that put this issue on the ballot, as saying, those who have the most power to lose will do whatever they can to keep hold of it. So is the question, is this simply a matter of the Republican Party wanting to stay in power?
No, and they recognized when setting up the structure that the Republican Party has an interest. That's why they gave four Republican commissioners. What they did not do was give the Republican Party or any members that are affiliated with it any ability to select or have an influence in the process of selecting their representatives. Every other state that's set up a commission like this has done so. It's a flaw in the way they set this up, and frankly, the onus is on them.
This is the second lawsuit filed by Republicans to block this independent commission or this process from drawing the maps. Why these separate suits?
That one is done by private plaintiffs. This one is done by the chair of the Republican Party and the Republican Party and officers from the Republican Party to represent a little different claims. But there are also equal protection claims, because what this also does is prevent people from exercising their ability to be on this commission. That one should have a history and experience to be on the commission, but two, also precludes them from being it if they're related to someone, which is another violation of the Constitution.
Attorney General Dana Nessel talks about that first one. She actually filed a brief with the court that says this is essentially no different than excluding people from jury duty who have a relationship to the parties or have a stake in the outcome of the case. What do you think of that argument?
I think her argument doesn't hold water. She's saying this is a conflict of interest. But in fact, like I said, there are four commissioners who are supposed to represent the Republican Party. That means the Republican Party has an interest in this. And what she's doing is trying to prevent the Republican Party from having any ability to choose who represents it or interact with them during the process, except in very minor circumstances. And that, frankly, is unconstitutional.
This redistricting process was approved by 61% of Michigan voters. You indicate that it's flawed, but what does that 61% tell you?
That there are people who were willing to vote in a proposal that they frankly didn't know was flawed. This, you know, regardless of how this was voted in, who voted in, it's unconstitutional, and therefore it can't be implemented.
Will the Republican Party or members of the party be filing any more lawsuits against the new redistricting process?
I can only answer for the lawsuit that we filed. We believe that it's unconstitutional, it's unfair, and that's why we filed this lawsuit.
The Supreme Court decided that it's not getting involved in the redistricting process. That's something for the states. But these lawsuits are filed in federal court.
Well, what the federal courts, what the U.S. Supreme Court decided was that voters could take a remedy into their hands if they want to apply redistricting. But this remedy that voters have voted for is unconstitutional, and it's unconstitutional by equal protection and by First Amendment and right of association. By the First and 14th Amendment, we believe this is unconstitutional and that the Supreme Court will see those flaws and will rule it unconstitutional.
Do you believe that Michigan has a problem with gerrymandering?
I think right now we're open to a process on how to redistrict. It just has to be fair and constitutional.
Stu Sandler is general counsel for the Michigan Republican Party. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Gathering will be held just outside of the Detroit Convention Center next week to celebrate its new corporate-sponsored name. The Cobo Center was named after a 1950s Detroit mayor. In the past few years, the name Cobo became controversial as the mayor's racist policies were acknowledged. I spoke with Detroit historian Jamon Jordan in 2017 about the legacy of former Mayor Cobo and what changing the name of the convention center might mean for Detroit's residents. I began by asking Jamon to give us some background on Mayor Cobo.
Albert Cobo, who is the namesake of the Cobo Center, was the mayor from 1951 to 1957, and he is a controversial figure in Detroit's history. As mayor, he ran on a platform of segregation, keeping African Americans out of predominantly white neighborhoods. And of course, in the middle of his, actually starting in the beginning, but really finishing a lot of it in the middle of his terms as mayor, his two terms as mayor, he demolishes or is part of the urban renewal policies in the city of Detroit and destroying the historic African American neighborhood, Black Bottom, and of course, the beginning of the destruction of the African American business district, Paradise Valley. So he is, of course, highly controversial. Many people don't know this history. People know very little about Cobo. They just know that his name is on the convention center downtown. But his history is really it should be an infamous history, particularly for political leadership in the city of Detroit.
Now, we often hear about how Black Bottom was demolished, Paradise Valley disappeared. Why were those areas important to African Americans in Detroit? Tell us about them.
Yeah, so African Americans, as they were moving, leaving the South and coming to Detroit during the Great Migration, and African Americans were leaving by the thousands from the South because, of course, they were looking for economic opportunities in the North. Many African Americans were low-skilled laborers in the South and, in some cases, sharecroppers and tenant farmers, which was just really a step above chattel slavery. And so they were leaving those conditions in hopes of finding a better economic life for themselves. But they were also leaving as refugees from terrorism, because in the South, of course, this was the period of high levels of lynching, one or two African Americans being killed by mobs at least every day somewhere in the South. And so African Americans are leaving not just for a better economic life, they're leaving for life itself. And so they come to cities like Detroit and Chicago and Philadelphia and Cincinnati, and they're coming for a better economic opportunity, and the auto industry is one of the main drivers. And of course, the wars as well, World War I first, and then World War II are the main drivers of African Americans coming to the city of Detroit to find better lives for themselves. And they run into Detroit's version of Jim Crow, which is housing segregation. At least that's a major part of it. And so they are concentrated in the Lower East Side of the city of Detroit. And that neighborhood is known as Black Bottom, not originally named that for African Americans, but named that for the soil. But eventually people forgot about the soil origin and began to speak of it in terms of the African American community. And since African Americans are discriminated against in housing discrimination and in property discrimination and in business, they create their own business district from their own cooperative activities and create a business district known as Paradise Valley. Of course, today, much of that is now the area where Fort Field and Comerica Park and, of course, the I-75 freeway sits where formerly Hastings Street sat. But that was the Black Business District, 350 Black-owned businesses by the 1930s. So that's a highly important area in Detroit's history.
If Albert Cobo was a racist mayor, why are we just now coming to grips with his name on the convention center?
Yes, a lot of the racism in the city of Detroit, particularly the racist political leaders in the city of Detroit, has been a hidden history, hasn't been talked about. Part of the blame, of course, lies with the media. This has not been reported. Of course, in the region, when people think of racially tense political leaders, Coleman Young's name always comes up. But what's missing is this intense racist history of white mayors in the city of Detroit. Albert Cobo is just one of them, but I mean, Detroit actually had a mayor who was highly supported by the Ku Klux Klan, and many would argue was himself a member of the Ku Klux Klan, elected in 1930, Charles Bowles. But many people don't know that history as well. And so many of these political leaders are being given a second look, particularly by historians and especially by African-American historians like myself, but others who are beginning to look at the history of Detroit's battle with segregation, racism, and white supremacy.
Is losing Cobo more a matter of money or a sense of distancing the city from a sad chapter in Detroit's past?
Many people would probably call it a win-win on both levels. So one, you'd be able to remove the name of a political leader with a racist legacy. And at the same time, you're able to bring in dollars. So the selling of the name rights probably is considered a win-win for both the political leadership in the city of Detroit and the business community. So I call it conspicuous compassion. And conspicuous compassion is they give the money, but they want everybody to know that they gave the money.
Jamon Jordan is a historian, and he's with the Black Scroll Network History and Tours. Hey, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, toxic cyanobacteria blooms are spreading over much of the western basin of Lake Erie this year.
We're all on the same team. We all want to see the lake get cleaned up so that, because it affects more than drinking water.
We'll check in with a water plant operator in Monroe about this year's blooms and how they're being monitored. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Researchers are monitoring the spread of cyanobacteria in the western basin of Lake Erie. It's bad this year. I mean, some of that cyanobacteria, which looks like blue-green algae on the water, can produce a toxin called microcystis. If not treated properly, it can contaminate drinking water. Joining us now is one of the people who runs a water purification plant that uses Lake Erie water. Chris Knight is the superintendent of Monroe's treatment plant. Welcome to the program.
All right, thank you. Glad to be here.
So what are you seeing in the water you're pulling from Lake Erie now?
During the month of July, for about the last couple weeks of July, we saw the algae bloom affect our intakes, our water coming into the plant. You know, normal pH of the lake water is like 8.1, and the pH has been as high as 9.3 because of the algae, through photosynthesis, uses up all the oxygen and creates hydroxides, which, of course, raises the pH. So, but then again, after July, for about 3 or 4 days, it went away. And right now, it's hit and miss. We're right on the edge of the bloom, the algae bloom. But you know, right now, it seems to have gone away. But, you know, it comes and goes as the wind shifts directions.
So how do you monitor for cyanobacteria blooms?
Okay, we have what's called real-time monitoring equipment out at our intake station, and one of the probes or sensors that is in this equipment is a phycocyanin sensor, which is also, you know, the same thing. It's in blue-green algae, and it tells us how much is in there, and then we have a cyanotoxin management plan that we use that tells us, you know, it's a plan with the DEQL, now they're Eagle.
Everybody's getting used to that. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so we have a cyanotoxin management plan, and on Wednesdays we test for the cyanotoxins. And in our raw and finished water, we've never had a detect in our finished water. We do get small detects in our raw water, which, I mean, as long as there's an algae bloom, it's expected. But Monroe is unique. We're an ozone plant. We add ozone to the water for taste and odor issues, and we have ever since the late 1970s because, I mean, the Western Basin, even without the blue-green algae, you know, because of the, it's so shallow, usually always has algae issues. It just doesn't always, you know, it just isn't always blue-green algae.
How does using ozone differ from other water treatment plants?
Okay, ozone is a one of the strongest disinfectants. It's an oxidant. And it's what happens is it's bubbled up through the water by diffusers. And as the ozone goes through the water, it removes taste and odor-causing organisms produced by algae. And in this case, for blue-green algae or cyanotoxins, it destroys the cells. It destroys the cells, the algae, and then it also, after the cells are ruptured, it also destroys the toxins that are produced. You know, and I know more and more plants are going to ozone. Right now I can't tell you who does and who doesn't have it, but I know that different plants that have issues in the past in Ohio are now treating or are adding ozone to their treatment process.
Since cyanobacteria like warmer water, how is climate change affecting this phenomenon?
We started seeing, you know, of course you remember they cleaned up the Great Lakes and Lake Erie back in the 70s. And we started noticing the algae, the blue-green algae, in the early 2000s, we would see increasing pH and, you know, different characteristics of an algae bloom back then, but it wasn't as often as it is now. The water's warmer, and as the water gets warmer and we get more rain like we usually have been getting, it draws phosphorus from...
It's a pretty well-known fact.
Well,
that
I don't
want
to go that way, though.
Yeah, well, I will, because the chief causes of these cyanobacteria blooms are runoff from crop and livestock farms. Not the only causes, but they certainly are a significant contributor.
So, I will agree with you on that, yes.
5 years ago, Toledo shut down its water system because basically an abundance of caution when it found Microcystis cyanobacteria. What are the chances that Toledo or you would have to shut the water off to your customers this year?
Well, this year we've tested for cyanotoxins every Wednesday. Our detects have been very minimal. 2 days ago we tested and it was like 0.37 parts per billion. If at any point when our raw water or our source water goes above five parts per billion, that's when we start testing on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. But, you know, we haven't had any after or before 2 days ago, before this past Wednesday, for the last 2 weeks, it was not detected in our source water and in our distributor's treated water. And then 2 weeks before that, we had another minor detect. So it's, you know, it comes and goes just depending on, you know, what algae's dying off and releasing the toxins. But the toxins over the past 5 years have not been as bad as they were in 2014. And we maintain and we meet all regulations. You know, we treat our water and meet all state EPA and EGLE regulations. It's all about public health. It's all about our customers. And we do everything we have to do to make sure that the water stays safe. You know, it's like I said, you know, it's, we're all on the same team. We all want to see the lake get cleaned up so that, because it affects more than drinking water. As you are well aware, it affects the boating industry. Because who wants to go out fishing and boating in green water? And so, you know, it affects more than just water treatment plants. So, you know, the total goal, the end goal should be to fix the problem rather than always creating Band-Aids for it.
Chris Knight is the superintendent of the Monroe Water Treatment Plant. Thanks for talking with us.
No problem. I appreciate it.
Let's turn now to Dave Spangler. He's vice president of the Lake Erie Charter Boat Association. So how does this explosion of cyanobacteria blooms interfere with fishing?
Well, it interferes not so much from the fish, but the people that want to go fishing. You know, this has happened for a lot of years in a row now. And what happens is we don't get the phone calls anymore. Late July, definitely all of August and most of September, because people just do not want to go out and deal with that. The folks are able to see through media, through the newspaper, TV, and now you can look at satellites and see that the Western Basin is, you know, partially or fully covered with algae, and they just do not want to go out there.
Yeah, besides not getting the phone calls, I mean, what are your customers asking you or saying when they decide to cancel or not book?
Yeah, and it works both ways. If they've got one, they cancel, or in a lot of cases, they'll reschedule. And in some cases, they'll just move it into next year because we you know, obviously we're able to fish for walleye most any time, and we start in April. They know that there are areas, depending on what the winds are doing and where it moves it, we can find some places with clear water, at least not something that looks too bad. But unfortunately, sometimes it's a, you know, 16, 18, 20-mile run. And right. Unfortunately, from where we're at, that'll put us into Canada, you know. So it becomes a deal where instead of going fishing, you're doing boat riding. And, of course, that is not what people want to do. They're spending their money to go fishing. So
what are they concerned about? Because, you know, not all cyanobacteria is toxic or has toxins. And even if you're in a patch of that, it doesn't affect the fish, does it?
In some cases it can. It depends upon the thickness and what's going on. Most of the time it doesn't affect the fish that much. But the reason people don't want to go out is, number one, no one can ever tell us, is this toxic or isn't it? And we have no way of knowing that. So when you're out there, obviously you're breathing in. You're probably going to have at least your hands wet handling fish, that kind of stuff that comes through it.
Right.
So it's just one of those things that it's a precautionary thing, and just we're not going to go out there.
Environmentalists feel the state of Ohio is not taking this as seriously as it should. It's relying chiefly on voluntary efforts by farmers to reduce the nutrients from farm runoff that feeds these cyanobacteria blooms. What do you think needs to be done?
Well, I agree with that assessment. We have gone through 8-10 years now of voluntary things, and it hasn't worked. Unfortunately, as with any group of people, we have a lot of people that will do the right thing, and unfortunately, we've got a percentage that do not do the right thing and have not changed their methods of what they do. It has reached a point where, to my feeling, we need to go to regulations on certain things, and especially things like soil testing. We do know that there are people out there still applying either fertilizer or manure on fields that, in some cases, actually do not need any at all. So those are the kind of things that have to happen. And, of course, that's going to need some regulations from not only the Department of Agriculture, but the legislature in the state of Ohio. And that would work also for the state of Michigan and Indiana. It's a far-flung issue, but it needs more help than what we're getting at this point in time.
Dave Spangler is Vice President of the Lake Erie Charter Boat Association. Thanks for talking with us.
No problem. Thank you.
Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer and Republican legislative leaders are talking, but there's not real movement on finding money to fix the roads. The governor wants to increase fuel taxes, as we've told you in the past. The Republicans want to shift the sales tax part of taxes on gasoline to fund the roads, but then that means schools and municipalities might lose some money. Here to discuss that are T.J. Buchholz, the president of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm in Lansing, and Ken Sikkema, senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader in the Michigan State Senate. So, TJ, just to be clear, right now the sales tax portion of taxes on gasoline does not all go to roads. What is Speaker of the House Lee Chatfield suggesting the state do?
Well, I think what the speaker is trying to do is come up with a comprehensive budget that covers all the squares that state government is supposed to cover with the dollar they have. And clearly that's not working. What they suggested, and they're not really talking about it, but what they suggested to Governor Whitmer yesterday, while it would have provided additional revenue for roads, allegedly cuts, you know, hundreds of dollars from the foundation allowance for schools, for each individual school.
Hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah. So that's just per school, but it's millions of dollars away from schools. So I'm worried about the process at this point. I know we've talked about this in the past, and it just seemed to me yesterday like Republican leaders who said they'd spend all summer working on a comprehensive plan came to the governor with ideas jotted down on cocktail napkins. And that's not how you solve the budget, especially at this juncture when we're you know, almost 30 days away from a potential shutdown.
Ken, you've been through this process. What do you think about what's happening so far?
Well, I'm not as, pessimistic or discouraged as TJ might be. I've seen this before. I've participated in it. And we just have to give them room to talk about it and negotiate a deal. You know, this is how these things happen. You know, you sometimes will have a false start. Some days you think you made a lot of progress. The next day you're madder than a wet hen. And you say, I'm never going to talk to that person again. And then 12 hours later, you're back at the table. I mean, it's just, that's the way these things work. It's kind of ugly, and it's almost always what you see publicly is probably not really what's going on. And I think they're going to come to a resolution.
Ken, I wanted to ask you, what do you think of using all of the taxes on gasoline to pay for the roads?
I like that idea, but there's a caveat and a qualifier. You have to make up the difference to local schools and to local governments. You can't just leave them hanging. You can't realize, if you will, or have the result being significant cuts or any cuts to education and local government.
This is all complicated by the Republican majority in both houses of the legislature and their desire to reduce income taxes. TJ, how does that plan work in getting a budget together?
You know, Lester, I just don't think that this budget can be all things to all people. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a wherewithal among sort of Republican leadership to raise taxes significantly to cover the revenue that we need to balance this budget, especially with the priorities that have been declared. I mean, and Ken's right. I mean, you know, if you want to take all the gas tax and put it into the roads, that is fine. But you know, you're talking about millions of dollars in shortfalls to schools. Municipalities have taken it on the chin for 15 to 20 years, you know, to the tune of $8.6 billion in revenue that cities and villages should have. So, I mean, I think this particular budget, we're reaching a breaking point, especially with the sort of the boundaries that the Republicans and Democrats have laid out here. And I think it's going to be a very testy 30 days before we reach the October 1.
So I didn't hear an answer about the reduced income taxes. Do you think that's going to happen or not?
You know, I think that that's always a Republican dog whistle. You know, we want to reduce income taxes. We want to reduce property taxes. We want to reduce, you know, people's dependency on government. And I think at the end of the day, you can't do that anymore. While it sounds like a good mantra, it's just not feasible to give people an income tax cut while we are talking about severe problems with roads, severe problems with schools. I think it's a Republican panacea that's not real.
So, Ken, what do you think? Can they reduce the income tax, raise more money to fix the roads, and not harm state services and those of schools and local government?
No. You can't cut the income tax in this environment. We need new revenue dedicated to roads. We can't rob Peter to pay Paul. And the notion that in this situation where you need significant new revenue to fix a problem, you can't and should not cut other areas of the budget, it's not possible to cut the income tax.
Unlike the federal government, Michigan has to pass a balanced budget. Can divided government in this state manage that without missing a deadline hitting a government shutdown? TJ?
Well, I think that's the hope, obviously. You know, again, they've been talking about a continuation budget. You know, they've done that in the past. You know, in 2007 and 2009, state government shut down for, you know, a few hours or even a day. And that's fine. But, you know, if you go back in history, 30 or 40 years, there have been some continuations that have gone longer. I think when we look at, you know, this negotiation, something has to give here. And the governor has said, and it really in back, you know, in February and March, put herself on the line and said, we can solve this with a stroke of a pen. I'm going to put my reputation on the line and say, let's do 45 cents in a gas tax. It has not been popular. It has not been, you know, particularly welcomed by Michigan citizens, but she was willing to do that because she recognizes we have a problem. And, you know, to be fair, even, you know, Senator Shirky and Speaker Chatfield have both said, at different junctures in this process, that there needs to be new revenue. And I think that we're not going to escape that. We have to have some new revenue, not just to fix the roads in the short term, but also to plug some of these holes we have in other areas in the budget.
Ken, we're going to get a budget before we have to shut down government or get a continuation?
It's very unlikely to have a government shutdown. It doesn't serve anybody's political interest to do that. Things would really have to go south in a hurry in the last few hours for that to happen. I think it's very unlikely. It's possible to have a continuation budget, but at some point you have to get closure.
Ken Sikkema is senior policy fellow at Public Sector Consultants and a former Republican majority leader of the Michigan Senate. T.J. Buchholz is president of Vanguard Public Affairs, a progressive political strategy firm in Lansing. Thanks very much, you two, and have a great weekend.
Thanks, Lester.
Thanks, Lester.
Still to come, the mummy of an Incan girl was sent back to Bolivia from Michigan State University. We'll talk with an MSU professor who worked for years to get the mummy sent back to its home. That's next on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. This week, the mummy of an Incan girl was sent back to Bolivia. It had been donated to Michigan State University in the 19th century. Bill Lovis worked for years to get the mummy sent back to Bolivia. Lovis is a professor emeritus of anthropology at Michigan State University, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So how did this Incan mummy end up at Michigan State to begin with?
We have limited information, but basically the accession record from Michigan State University suggests that it was donated by William B. McCreary, who was a board of trustees member at MSU in the late 19th century. William McCreary was the U.S. consul to Chile at the time, and somehow he obtained an Incan mummy along with a variety of objects that had been placed with her in a stone tomb south of La Paz. And we don't know how it came either out of the stone tomb, how he acquired it, or it's the precise way in which it was transported to MSU, but it did arrive here in 1890 and was accessioned into the MSU collections.
Well, let's talk about the mummy itself.
Sure.
How far does it date back?
Okay, we have a radiocarbon date that puts it in the mid-15th century, so in the 1470 range. And that radiocarbon date comes from some corn, a kernel of corn that was in a pouch with the mummy. So if the radiocarbon date is correct, it is, in fact, something that dates prior to the arrival of Columbus in the Western Hemisphere, and certainly prior to the European conquest of the Inca.
Why was it important to you to return this Incan girl, this mummy of this Incan girl, back to her homeland?
A number of years ago, back in about 1980, several of the curators at the MSU Museum came to the conclusion that it was really inappropriate for MSU to be displaying human remains in a public space. And so we catalyzed a movement to remove her from exhibition, and she was. And so she came off exhibit. So there was that part of it. The second part of it had to do with storage facilities. We have storage facilities that are relatively stable in terms of their temperature and humidity, but they are certainly not designed for the long-term storage of mummified human remains. Thirdly, I tried to get a number of people interested in doing some basic documentary research on the mummy, and I was unsuccessful at doing that. So, you know, with that trifecta in place, I spoke with our acting director at the time, Laura Helou, and I posed the proposition that we, in fact, based on these three observations, that perhaps it would be a better thing for us to do and repatriate to Bolivia.
Well, let's talk about why it took so long. I mean, besides the coca leaves she's carrying, why did it take so long to send it back to Bolivia?
One doesn't just say, gee, we're going to give you back your mummy, and then somehow give it to somebody, and then it's done. This is governed by bilateral accords between the United States and the nation that one wishes to repatriate to. And so these bilateral accords basically tell us that what we need to do is initiate conversations with the appropriate parties in the potentially recipient state, and that what we want to do is we have to actually ask them whether they would be willing to receive the human remains. Or any artifacts, any cultural materials that we might potentially want to return. So these are all bureaucratic procedures. She was also buried with plant materials that are still used in local ritual, things like corn and beans, and even a pouch full of coca leaves, which posed a very interesting issue for the repatriation.
My bad.
We had to involve the Drug Enforcement Administration through the Office of General Counsel that we had controlled substances, even though they were 500 years old and had no toxins left in them. They were still controlled by legislation, by the law. So we had to work through that. So you know, even though I, in many respects, you know, was the person who coordinated a lot of this, I could not have done it without literally dozens of other people, and I'm not even naming a lot of the people who were involved in some of the scientific documentation.
It seems like the fact that Michigan State University owned the remains of this little girl, it seems a very odd concept, but yet it's happened in Western countries all over Europe and North America. How has thinking changed recently about that?
Well, it depends on the institution, and it depends on the Western country as to how they view that kind of concept. Most of the archaeologists and museum people that I work with really don't look at the ownership of human remains by an institution as an appropriate perspective on the way in which human remains might or should be treated. On the other hand, most of the museum people and archaeologists and physical anthropologists I know are eager to learn as much about the past as we can from those human remains. So at some level, there needs to be a cooperative relationship that allows that kind of scientific research to take place.
How do you feel about the return of this little girl's remains to her homeland?
Well, actually, I feel very good that it has finally been accomplished. And in fact, it was only really accomplished about 2 weeks ago, even though I started all of this in early 2016. I was very pleased that all of the time and effort that both I and other people had put into returning her to her country and to appropriate storage with custodianship that would allow the Bolivian people to have access to her, that all of that had been accomplished, that we were successful at doing that. So I was really quite gratified that the effort that we'd put into it at a variety of different institutional levels actually had a positive effect here, and that she will be properly cared for, and she will be able to be a part of the tangible heritage of Bolivia for the Bolivian people.
Bill Lovis is Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Michigan State University. Thanks for telling us about this young lady.
My pleasure.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Climate change is beginning to disrupt the planet. Here in Michigan, we're seeing more intense precipitation, changes in plant growth and migration, changes in the range of pests, and even animal migration. So what are people doing about it? Well, some are really looking at their life and how it contributes to the greenhouse gas emissions and making adjustments. Others are overwhelmed by all the contributing factors, and they're not really doing anything. Others don't feel the little bit of greenhouse emissions produced by their day-to-day life is significant enough to worry about, and still others deny human activities have anything to do with climate change. Our next guest researches these kinds of everyday environment-related ethical dilemmas. Paul Thompson is a professor at Michigan State University and the W.K. Kellogg Chair in Agriculture, Food, and Community Ethics. Welcome to the program.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So how much does the average American think about their personal contributions to the cause of climate change?
Well, I think the way that you set it up is a pretty good representation. There are some people that are intensely interested in this, and there are some people on the opposite extreme that are skeptical of the whole story. I think it's almost a bell curve distribution in terms of where people are. I think most people are concerned about this and think about it occasionally, but don't really have the time or the mental space to be thinking about it on a purchase-by-purchase decision.
So how much should we be thinking about our personal contributions to climate change?
Well, first, I want to indicate that I'm not one of those skeptics at the far extreme. I do think these are really important issues, and I consider myself to be an environmentalist in that sense. So I think it's good that people are thinking about it, but I'm also not on that extreme that suggests that every time we go order lunch at a restaurant, you know, we have to do a little environmental risk assessment. I think that we really need to recognize that we just have to develop better habits and not really try to think through all of the environmental impacts on a decision-by-decision basis.
Well, having heard that, how are people actually supposed to negotiate trying to become more environmentally friendly when the efforts sometimes seem an extreme departure from our normal lives?
Well, I think there are two things to say. The first, and I think the most important thing to say, is that people, everyday people, should be supportive of the efforts to make policy-level improvements. And by policy-level, I mean both government, both regulation, but also decisions that are made in the private sector when corporations, you know, create sustainability divisions and start to look at the overall impact of their practices and the kind of products they're selling. Those are really good things, and we should be supportive of that at a political level. We should, you know, vote for those kinds of things. Those are probably the key places where we're going to have the most significant impact. Also, at a personal level, I do think people should take a little time out now and then and, you know, think about this, have a little meditation, you know, structure their leisure time activities so that they're learning a little bit more about sustainability and a little bit about more about the environment. But I think that's quite different from sort of approaching every item at the grocery store from an environmental impact standpoint.
Well, let me challenge your first point. You know, it sounds like I'd have to do a lot of research about any corporation I'm buying a service or a product from. That could be pretty overwhelming in itself.
Yeah, that's exactly what I don't think you should be doing. When I say, you know, you should support this, it's almost more, you know, in your conversations with friends and your interactions on social media, you know, don't make fun of that kind of stuff. That stuff's really important. And if you're inclined to make fun of it, you know, I would encourage you to think a little bit more about it. So I do think that at the level of a corporation or even a small business, it's important for them to really take the responsibility seriously and make the decisions that work for them. And then you know, we should support it to the extent that we can make sense of it, but not belabor it at, like you say, you know, spending all your time reading corporate sustainability reports.
Let's go further into that. I mean, where or how do I strike the balance between a traditional American lifestyle and a lifestyle which actually helps reduce my carbon footprint and can otherwise help the environment?
Well, I think that people can do things that help. One of probably the simplest things that you could do is to just try not to engage in wasteful consumption activities, buying stuff you don't really need, you know, encouraging, you know, I mean, something as simple as not taking that plastic straw at the restaurant when you're offered it. I think those kinds of things, you know, they help, but they almost help symbolically as much as they help in terms of actually reducing the overall load. I think that as we become culturally more supportive of sustainability and taking it seriously, a lot of these things start to flow naturally. We start to see firms taking these kinds of things more seriously. I've certainly observed that in the agriculture and food domain, where looking at the environmental impact is now something that every major company really spends quite a bit of time thinking about, and increasingly ordinary farmers are spending more time thinking about.
It seems like it's fairly easy to alienate a big section of the population as well. And I say that because a few years ago, a researcher implied that a big dog produces as much greenhouse gas emissions as an SUV. People went crazy. Attacking them for having a dog seemed to cross a line. So what should society consider when drawing that green line between helping and hurting the planet and accomplishing what they want to do?
Well, one of the things that I think is important there is that it's less what any individual does than what we do as a total population. So you can kind of think about this in terms of averages. You know, you should try to bring your contribution to that average down, but you shouldn't beat yourself up if you like dogs, for example, or for that matter, if you drive an SUV. Just try to look for some other ways that you might compensate in other aspects of your daily activity, as opposed to trying to make every choice that you make reach some sort of idealistic optimum.
Yeah, you know, there are a lot of people screaming at the radio right now because of what you just said.
I love dogs.
Well, I was talking about, you know, we should be doing everything possible because this is the most significant issue in our lives at this point, according to many people, and I consider myself to be among them, although I'm just as guilty as the people who are, you know, shrugging their shoulders saying, what can you do? So it's a confusing topic for a lot of us, even though, you know, some of us believe we should be doing something for the planet and never know where to really start.
Well, I think one of the things that I would say here is that, I started out by saying, you know, I'm sort of in this camp. I consider myself to be working in environmental ethics, you know, but when it becomes overly moralized, when it becomes presented as a moral obligation that everybody ought to follow, or as you put it, something that you view as the most important thing. I understand why people view it that way, and I guess I have to confess I often think that way myself, but I live in a world where many of the people that I interact with on a day-to-day basis as a university professor are much more concerned about racial justice or gender justice or social inequality. And I kind of step back and say, well, you know, those are pretty important things too. And am I going to criticize them because they think that is a higher priority or because that's what dominates their thinking as opposed to looking at the environmental impact of their actions? And at that point, I actually start to think that, you know, I mean, one of the principles that we have in ecology is that diversity is a good thing. And so maybe it's a good thing that, you know, some of us do think that the environment's the most important issue, but others have other topics that they kind of, you know, rise to the top of their decision making.
Paul Thompson is the W.K. Kellogg Chair in Agriculture, Food, and Community Ethics at Michigan State University. Hey, I enjoyed the conversation. Thanks.
Thank you.
Next week on Stateside, we'll talk to Michigan Radio's John Eubacon about his new book on Michigan football, and we'll hear from the members of our climate crew, people working to make Michigan a greener place. That's Stateside for today. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.